Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, July 27, 2017. Tonight's main science topic, I'm going to continue talking about water, past, present, and future on Earth, and glaciation and ice caps, Atlantis, ancient continents, mass extinctions, you know, the things that they that they don't teach you about in school. That you never heard before, you know, in the classroom, where they teach you complete garbage. Excuse me, but that's the extent of it. But I also have a very interesting twist on all of this tonight. Now, I've talked before about the fact that when these events occur and when we have interaction with comets. Large comets, not the little poofy Halley's Comet-type comets, but the big ones, which we know have happened in the memory of man, let's put it that way, in historical, within the communication we get that's handed down to us from the ancients, that the Earth's atmosphere has been changed drastically. I've talked before about after the Noah's Flood, we see a rainbow. We see a rainbow, which they were surprised at. They had never seen that before. Well, that tells you that the atmosphere changed, and rightfully so. We had a massive inundation of water. Clearly, that would have changed drastically the atmosphere. And along with that, passing through the comet tail, possibly a big influx of other types of gases. And let me just give you an example. Right now, our Earth's atmosphere, let me just quick pull up these numbers. Okay, looking at the table, and this table, by the way, will be on my webpage so you can take a closer look. Current composition of Earth's atmosphere, which has changed drastically, rapidly, and certainly cause stress on the beings or animals, plants, etc., that were on Earth at the time. Okay, so currently the major component, 78% nitrogen. But wait a minute. This is not a species, a molecular species, that we find in our neighborhood of the solar system. Nitrogen, you find out by, you know, beyond Saturn, you find nitrogen in, beyond basically Saturn and beyond in abundance. You don't find it in the inner planets, nor do you find it in Jupiter, nor in Saturn really itself. But that means that, for example, the large moons of Saturn, which are rich in nitrogen, have... that's common in that part of the solar system, but not where we are. Oxygen, okay, so that's 78% oxygen, or 78% nitrogen, over three-quarters of our atmosphere being nitrogen. Okay, oxygen, 21%, very interesting, and 0.1% trace components, of which the majority of that trace component, 0.1% of Earth's atmosphere, is carbon dioxide. Now, I just want to point out for all of the people who, you know, the global climate change hysteria people, we could send the carbon dioxide level of Earth 200 times, and it would still be a smidgen of the atmospheric composition of Earth. And what we really should have is oxygen. Now, imagine people thinking, given this dichotomy, this diverse, this askew amount of oxygen, literally we have about 210 times as much oxygen in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Now, some people want to tell you that there's a cycle between plants that recycle the oxygen. They breathe in carbon dioxide. And really, both humans and animals at 21% oxygen are lacking in oxygen. We're burning our oxygen here to run our cars and petroleum fuels, natural gas, the biggest sources of energy that we have, and burning coal, which is by far the biggest consumption, burning consumption of oxygen. We're burning up the oxygen that we breathe. And I'm going to get to some medical evidence shortly. But how can, okay, so we've got oxygen is O2, carbon dioxide is CO2. So you have a carbon hooked on to oxygen. So the plants supposedly give us back the oxygen that we need, that we desperately need to breathe, is the story of some people. Well, how can 1/210th the amount of carbon dioxide give us the oxygen we need? It's so beyond absurd. I mean, this is, you know, this is beyond outer space, way deep orbit absurd. But they print it in a textbook, people repeat it, hey, good to go. Absolutely absurd. So, what should we have on planet Earth? Well, let's look at historical levels. What were the historical levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide a long time ago? Well, it turns out that oxygen was probably double the amount that we have today. So that when you breathe in, your lungs have so much capacity, 3/4 of that is nitrogen. Now, there's a therapy that athletes use. It's used in medical practice. It's becoming more commonly used. It's called HBOT, hyperbolic oxygen treatment. And what they do is they put you in a tank and raise the pressure, but they raise the pressure by pumping in pure oxygen. And it's curing people of all kinds of diseases. And a lot of these diseases are caused by oxygen deficiency, which is caused by the fact that we don't have enough oxygen in the atmosphere. Well, man is related to this planet. Just like plants grow, they need certain minerals to grow. Some require different minerals and mineral combinations than other plants. But that is why some plants grow good in certain areas and other plants grow well in other areas. But plants, and people have done this, they've done experiments where they take an enclosed greenhouse, they pump up the carbon dioxide to 2 or 3 times normal level, and the plants go crazy. They, you know, keep the temperature like jungle-type conditions, and these plants just go bananas growing. And that tells you something, too, that the previous carbon dioxide levels on planet Earth were much higher, and we did not have a runaway greenhouse effect, which caused a massive extenuation of the temperature, and then everything died off. No. When you put carbon dioxide in a greenhouse, and remember, it's carbon monoxide that's poisonous. That's the one that gets in your blood. It looks like oxygen, so your blood picks it up and moves it around, and it's really a poison. So carbon monoxide is the dangerous one. Carbon dioxide, it's really not harmful to humans as such. Then this hysteria over global warming, I don't know. That's it's bizarre to me. But recently, you've seen more and more atmospheric scientists, geologists, etc., getting up and saying, hey, we need more CO2 on this planet. That would make the plants grow better. But I just want to say this concept that the plants somehow give us oxygen back. Now, one time I was sitting in an airport up in the north. It was winter, a cold winter day. I was looking out the window of the airport over the countryside, and I could see in the distance the trees and the woods out there with no leaves. You know, it looks like you're living on the moon. And just totally barren. Well, you know, for 6 to 8 months of the year in those northern climate, there's no plant life. There's no recycling of CO2. So how do the people live there? Where does the oxygen come from? Well, the oxygen is in the atmosphere. Anybody that tells you that oxygen is recycled for our breathing supply, of course, plants, when they take in carbon dioxide, they take it in, and then they exhale oxygen. That happens. That's perfectly well understood. But do the plants in the world or the Amazon jungle replace the oxygen, and then we breathe out carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide, and then does that somehow is that somehow used by the plants and recycles our oxygen supply? No, the carbon dioxide is 1/210th as much of the atmospheric composition. So the balance is way out of whack. To imagine that if we depended on that cycle for oxygen, hey, we'd have been all dead a long time ago. Try and take the oxygen content down to 0.1%. Go for it. You know, anybody that's telling you that there's a cycle between carbon dioxide and our oxygen that we need to breathe, tell them to cut their oxygen supply down to 0.1%. Because that's all that, if you took all the carbon dioxide in the world, in the atmosphere, and converted it to oxygen, if you took it all, there would not be enough to keep any human being or animal alive for more than like a minute. Think about that. How stupid is the science that they're teaching kids in school today? It's absurd. But not just kids. This goes all the way up to PhD levels. You find people with PhDs repeating this trope. But I wanted to get back to this topic of hyperbolic oxygen treatment. And now let's look at this from a different point of view. In the Old Testament and the old texts that come down to us, they talk about people living for hundreds of years. Well, how do they do that? Was that just a myth? Did they have, you know, bad counting systems? Was their year different than ours? You know, exactly what was going on there? How come these people, you know, Methuselah, etc., could live 700 years? Well, maybe they did. And maybe they had a much different oxygen content, and maybe they had a much different carbon dioxide in which the plants grew like crazy. Maybe they lived in a completely different atmosphere. Look at this also. Well, majority of the world, people are buying creams. One of the biggest selling thing on the planet is skin cream. You put it on your skin because your skin is dry. Well, you know, if you look at your skin and compare it to, say, the skin of a lizard that lives out in the desert, they have this thick, scaly that, you know, keeps all the water in. And our skin is not like that. But when it gets dry, and I've been there, I've lived up in the cold climates part of my life. I've lived in places where you needed air conditioning, so the air is just bone dry. And your skin begins to feel like you're a lizard. It's dry, so what do? You go buy some cream and you put it on your hands, put it on your face, you know, and, you know, maybe your knees, your elbows, maybe you put it all over your arms. But people are constantly buying cream to smear all over the place because, you know, their skin is dry. You know, their lip Ivo, that lip stuff you put on your lips, you know, it's on and on and on. And so you are constantly trying to moisturize. That's a big selling thing. Humidifier or what do they call them? Humectants or, you know, creams that have moisturizers, etc. People constantly, you know, paying billions of dollars a year to put this on their skin. Well, why? Because man used to live in a totally different environment. More oxygen, more carbon dioxide, so the plants grew better. And just think, if all those plants are kicking that oxygen back out, now you can do this, and I've done this, we've all done this. You go out and walk in the forest, and you can see that there's, you can sense that there's a lot more oxygen there. Certainly, you're getting an extra dose of oxygen because all those plants, compared to you, the little person that's the size of an ant walking through these woods, those trees or brush or whatever are all kicking out oxygen, so you get an extra dose of oxygen, and it makes you feel good. Well, what if you lived in a place with a lot more carbon dioxide and the plants consuming that carbon dioxide, kicking out the oxygen, but not only that, you had twice as much oxygen in the atmosphere. Now, there's a limit, and excess doses of oxygen are only given to people under medical supervision. And the reason is we've gotten away from breathing in high oxygen content atmosphere. But if you, let me just explain what another factor here is, pressure. The HBOT, which I'll just call them HBOT, the high hyperbolic oxygen treatment, not only puts you in a pure oxygen environment, but it does it under pressure. So it drives up the pressure in the containment vessel. You get in this thing, they close it up, they put in the oxygen, pressurize it, and you sit in there for a half hour, an hour, hour and a half. And then you get out and you get back to normal, and you do this every day for, say, a month or 2 months. And this is a treatment regimen, and it cures all kinds of diseases. The list, I mean, go online. You can read online. And the FDA has actually approved this for many, many, many chronic illnesses as a method of remedial therapy for people. Okay, so anyway, but imagine going back to where we have the mastodons. They were big animals. How did a mastodon live? Well, if they had an environment which was moist, a lot of water, tremendous amount of plant growth. Look, a mastodon, you know how much an elephant eats in a day? Like an elephant eats like, what, a couple times its weight every day in food, in green, etc. They're just ravenous eaters. Imagine what a mastodon ate. It was about 10 times the size of an elephant. Those babies put down some grub, you know, and they were not meat eaters. They were, you know, they ate plants, and but a lot of it. I mean, they were chowing down all day long. So they ate a tremendous amount of growth. So to sustain a mastodon herd, as you would find in Siberia, they were eating a lot of forage, let's just put it that way. And if you think about it, today's world could not support mastodons. The mastodon herds were vast, and remember that this is what Velikovsky pointed out in, I don't know if it was Worlds in Collision or Earth in Upheaval, Ages in Chaos, one of his three books where he's talking about the mastodons in Siberia. They were flash frozen on the plains of Siberia when it was much a temperate climate. But there were herds of these things, millions of them, like the buffalo. Well, they ate a lot more than the buffalo. They ate a lot more than the African elephant. So they had to be immersed in a location where there was serious amounts of vegetation. And, you know, talk about acres per animal, these guys could really chow down. So my point is, there is no place on Earth today that could support a large herd of mastodons. Okay? Also, when you get species like this that through natural adaption, which is a legitimate form of, we've seen this happen where animals become bigger and bigger. We've seen it in the human race. The football players, these big, big football players today, they're 6 feet 6, 320 pounds and can run like a rabbit. You know, these guys, believe me, they're big, they pack away a lot of food, etc. But there was nobody like that 100 years ago. A guy like that walked down the street 100 years ago and you'd have some eyebrows raising. Remember that the people that came over on the Mayflower were little people. They were like, 5 feet tall. The guys, the women were shorter. And so in that short amount of time, because of good food, because of people living longer, etc., the people have gotten big. We have women that are six, taller than me. I'm about a little under 6 feet maybe. But you got women who are, 6 foot 6. And that was not like that 100 years ago. So the mastodons, my point is, or you look at the dinosaurs, they grew to immense sizes, absolutely huge. And so the mastodons, the same. It took a long time for them to build up. And when the Venus event happened, and this is where the demise of the dinosaurs was in time, was the Venus event around, and there again I use Velikovsky's dating, which to me is the best dating to date. And I don't support dating, I don't recommend them, because there's many other factors, but that's, let's just say 1500 BC was a good date for the glaciation, for the pole shift, for the demise, the end of the Holocene period, the mastodons, etc. And prior to that, by a number of thousand years, was the Great Flood, in which both of these events, the atmosphere changed drastically. So I just want to jump back for one more second to the HBOT systems. These are a tank, or apparently there's ones that you can actually sit in, and you close it up. But athletes are using these. I believe it's under the medical care, or they have to, from what I understand, you need a prescription to use one of these. But it's becoming common use in athletics, especially, in athletics where you have a lot of healing that has to go on in a short period of time. And they just finished the Tour de France. You look at the way these guys are working, for what, 4 to 5 hours going all out. I mean, that's strenuous. And by the way, I just want to publicly give some comment on the Tour de France. I watch it for the scenery. I just love watching the French countryside and, all the different places and, dream of being there, sitting in a little cafe or something, or they go through the little towns, and it's a very, very colorful event. But the team that won, with, I think his name was Froome, congratulations to them, the fourth time winner, etc. But the guy that came in second, 54 seconds behind, remember, this is like almost 90 hours of bicycling. I get done with 1 or 2 hours and I'm okay, that's good enough for me, and not that intense certainly. But the guy that came in second was a poor kid from a South American country named Colombia, and came in, he didn't even have a team. Remember that the teams work where the teams have leaders, where they'll go out and push it really hard, and then the guy that they want to win is sitting back, riding the air, the air pocket, riding in the air pocket, where he can then break out at the end and And, you know, there's all kinds of tactics, team tactics, that allow these guys to win. But this kid from Colombia had nobody in a bike, which probably was not very good bike. And he comes in 54 seconds behind the leader. Anyway, something to watch there. Something's going on, you know, where these poor countries can now start to compete just out of absolute athletic ability, you know. So anyway, enough of that. But back to the H-Bot, where the athletes have a lot of repair going on in their bodies, you know, because they're in training and then they're in athletic competition. And so they're starting to use this as a technique to get into better shape and advance the healing process. But at any rate, that brings us back to the same issue, that people potentially could have been in much better physical condition, lived a lot longer, did not have the chronic problems. Look at what happens when people age. Their cardiovascular system breaks down, the aging process, they're not getting sufficient oxygen into all parts of their bodies. And so that is really one of the main causes of aging. So if people are not, if they have sufficient oxygen and they have a very good quality food supply because of the heightened CO2, and they're not breathing all of this nitrogen, which basically is a kind of like a filler, and it shouldn't even be here in the first place, we have to have scientists start studying the Earth's old atmosphere to imagine that the dinosaurs or the mastodons even lived in the same atmosphere that we live in is absurd. It couldn't possibly be true because the Earth doesn't support sufficient vegetation for a mastodon herd. Simply doesn't. Tell me a place. Okay. And if somebody's going out there, I don't believe that. Okay. Show me a place on planet Earth that would support a mastodon herd. Show me. That, and not only, okay, they could eat for today, tomorrow, okay, great. But it's got to regrow quickly to support that massive herd that's populating that vast savanna, you know, as fast as possible and in a temperate climate. And if you think that's a big order, or if you think that's no big deal, try populating it with dinosaurs that eat probably about 40 times what a mastodon eats in a day. Try that out, which is rather comical because where you find the dinosaur bones, like out in Wyoming, you'd be lucky to support, you know, a number of cattle per 5 acres, you know, it's something like that for vegetation. It's not like Wyoming or Montana where you're finding the dinosaur bones. Not like that's going to support dinosaurs. Excuse me. So we've seen some serious changes. And, you know, it really, really slays me when you just see people, oh, yeah, that's where the dinosaurs used to live. Those are the dinosaur fields. What? No, you couldn't support, you know, a country mouse out there, let alone a herd of dinosaurs. And they were big. So, you know, 65 million years, the dinosaurs grew and grew and grew, but the vegetation had to grow back at a very rapid pace to keep up with the herbivores, dinosaurs. And, of course, you had your meat eaters, too, the Tyrannosaurus Rex, but the big dinosaurs were vegetarian, let's just put it that way. I'm going to take a minute out here. There's actually some science announcements that I wanted to make, and usually I put those at the beginning of the show, but I just got rolling into this topic, which really is tremendously interesting for me, as you know, the ancient Earth. I want to talk about Atlantis here in a minute, but this past week we had a major solar flare. Now the sun has been very quiet, so for a long time. I don't even remember the last time we had an X-class flare. We have regular M-class flares, and when we do, it's like everybody in the astronomy or spaceweather.com goes crazy, like, oh, that's the biggest thing since sliced bread. But we had a real one this past week, and people compare it to the Carrington event in the mid-1800s that would have potentially knocked out a lot of electrical equipment on Earth, etc. In the 1990s, remember when Hale-Bopp was here, we saw flares like that going off all the time, and some of them hit Earth. And, you know, we saw effects from it. But I would say that people are probably exaggerating this X flare just because we haven't seen one for so long. By the way, it did not come at Earth, but it was off in the other direction. In fact, it went away from Earth on the far side of the sun. But that same sunspot is going to turn around and point at Earth here in a couple of days. So we'll be interesting. We'll be watching that. Also, NASA made an announcement this week that it discovered from a little glass beads. Sounds like somebody's trading for Manhattan back in the 1600s. But glass beads from the moon. Now, okay, if you can accept that, there was microscopic amounts of water in the glass beads from the moon. And so they were saying, well, there must be vast amounts of water down in the moon. But then in the same article, it says that the glass beads weren't even from the moon, that they were from outer space, not native to the moon. And anything you find on the surface of the moon is questionable as to whether it is native to the moon or not. So anyway, I wouldn't get out my water bottle quite yet, hoping to fill it up on the moon. But anyway, that's just trying to keep up on these announcements. Also, 2 weeks ago on my paid cast, I just want to announce this again because it was a very important show. It was called The Pope, Vatican, and Science. I consider that a must-listen show. And then last week, topic, Electric Highways to the Stars. Now, that particular show, Electric Highways to the Stars, is going to be in quite a few of my series. When I break the series out, like the Tesla's Mind or the Cosmos, the Real Story series, or the Earth Before the Great Flood series, that Electric Highways to the Stars will be in all of them. And so, in fact, probably the Pope, Vatican, and Science also. Those are germane to so many topics that so many directions that I cover. And so this week is simply called Proof. And so you may want to listen to that. If you're not a member of the paid cast, $3.95 a month. And you can join on my webpage. There's a link there to the subscription subpage. And I encourage everybody to do that. This whole idea of the paid cast was brought about by listeners. There's some people that do a strictly paid cast and don't do any type of public venue. So I'm still doing my free show, which is this one, the commercial free show. But then I'm doing the paid cast, and that helps me out a little bit, pays some of the bills. And also it gives me a venue where I don't have to talk about current events. I don't have to talk about anything. I just take a scientific topic. I dive in and for the entire hour. And so that allows me to make statements that will be then packaged, in a sense, and broken out into, you know, something that people will be listening to in 100 years. Then just a quick notice on my water filters. We are retooling the stainless steel kitchen, the container. We're retooling for that, so it's currently out of stock. And we'll have that back in a couple of weeks. But the advantage is that we will also have the Traveler, the smaller stainless steel water filter container. We'll have that back in stock. That was probably 30 to 40% of my sales were for the Traveler. So if you were looking for that before or you've been thinking about that, a lot of people would like that smaller one for an apartment, for traveling, and etc. Remember, for travel, I also have my 1 and 2 liter travel filters. But anyway, just when you go to my sales page, all the other stuff is there in stock. With, by the way, this sale is going to end. I promise it's coming down real soon. 10% off plus 5% additional off on the major water filter products. So go there. That's going to come down soon, maybe even this weekend. So jmccsci.com. Okay, enough of that announcement stuff. Back to the main article. Okay, so putting the world into perspective, before the Great Flood, after the Great Flood, the pole shift, I've talked about that, where the old North Pole, and by the way, make sure you go to my webpage. I have lots of pictures and additional explanations where you can see this. A lot of people have a hard time visualizing, you know, where the Laurentian Ice Shield would be in Ontario. And there are maps of this. I mean, we know exactly where this ice cap was, and that was the center of the old North Pole. And this Antarctica was a ice-free continent, and they're down there digging like crazy. They have found, believe me, the mother lode of archaeology and Earth history down there. The Smithsonian, whose job it is to sequester archaeological and historical evidence so the public doesn't see it. Man, they are down there like crazy, doing everything they can do to get all that, you know, I'm sure they have cities, archaeological cities. This is just an absolute treasure than being sequestered by the insane, I don't know what you even call them, people who have basically taken control of this planet. Just the mentally disturbed people. Because that is something, if you discovered it, that would be something that should be announced, that should be made public. If you remember, this was an interesting time in history. There was two guys, Catherwood and what was the other guy's name? It was John Lloyd Stevens and Frederick Catherwood. Now, Catherwood was the artist, and they went down into basically Mayan country. They had heard of tales and that there was this lost civilization. This is like, in the 1800s. And they go down, they take a steamship down, drop them off in Mexico, and these guys go wandering through the jungle and come across Palenque and Chichen Itza and Tikal. And Catherwood sits down and draws intricate. And if you've never seen the Catherwood prints in their original large format, I've had this book in my hand, and a good library would have it, but the original large format drawings of Catherwood, this guy was an amazing artist. And here are these Mayan cities overgrown with jungle. I mean, this would have been a surrealistic experience. Can you imagine in the early 1800s being dumped off on the eastern coast of Mexico and trucking through the jungle with your art equipment and finding these ancient cities and then bringing that back to New York and exposing it to the public? It was just, yeah, it was like Tesla's 1893 light show at the Chicago World Fair. It would have been at the same level of absolute, you know, astonishment of the public. But the point that I was trying to make was that the discoveries that are going on in South America now, and Antarctica especially, are just of a remarkable nature, and they're being sequestered by people that have no, it doesn't belong to them. These are secret societies, and they worship this. Now, this is once again getting back into this story of when Mars went under. And this was a long time, possibly 100 years, we don't even know how long, when Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans to the passing large comet Venus. We know that happened. Mars was a blue planet. It changed Mars' orbit to much farther away. Mars came much closer to Earth in those days, and there was clearly transportation. And so the same people are blocking information from Mars. And I've talked about this on my show before, and this is becoming exposed. But the Vatican has been sequestering, and these top-level agencies like the Smithsonian, Washington, and the CIA, etc., have been sequestering scientific information and archaeological information from all over the planet, and from Mars, and from Antarctica now. They are hiding this information and then feeding, you know what they say about, there's an expression we used to have when we work in a company, where they say they treat you like mushrooms. They keep you in the dark and you grow on horse, you know what. I mean, and it's about the same thing with what they're doing with people today. These people don't have a right to these ancient artifacts, etc. They don't have any special right to this. This is absurd. But they have the power to do it, and there's nobody challenging them. It's very important for somebody to get down there and try and find out what's going on in Antarctica. But I guarantee you, because of the activity going on there, this is archaeological, probably mastodons, and everything that goes with it. And it happened so quickly that they're probably finding human remains down there that were flash frozen. I mean, people just like remember the Santorini in Italy and the island that was covered in ash, and Crete in those some of those locations when the big volcano went off there and put everything under, you know, a mountain of ash, only to be discovered later. And the reason they discovered it is they were excavating ash and hauling it over to mainland Italy to build roads as bedding for roads. But anyway, back to Catherwood and Stevens. If you, excuse me, I'm sorry. If you look on, just go on the internet, you can see these drawings, these absolutely amazing drawings. And by the way, when I was young, I saw the Catherwood prints, and as I was living in Mexico, I saw the Catherwood prints, and the original ones, oh my goodness, they're big and they're just amazing detail. Even a picture would not, he had a way of bringing life out through his drawings. This guy was a fantastic artist, and had a way of bringing the life out of these ruins as they were overgrown in the jungle, still with the big cats that populated the jungle down there. I mean, it was very primitive at that point. You know, you can imagine early 1800s, southeastern Mexico and Yucatan, Belize, and Quintana Roo, and northern Guatemala, you know, etc., Honduras, some of those areas. Anyway, but the point is that information came back and was exposed, the public was exposed to it. Now, what's going on in Antarctica, which is a crime against humanity, it's being sequestered and hidden. I just want to include something in my notes here because I've talked about the pole shift. And what we're wrestling with, what we're Velikovsky was wrestling with was the change in the Earth's axis, the spin rate, the length of the day, the number of days in the year. And we really don't have good information from before then. We don't have information that would allow us to rebuild the orbit as it was then, least of all the orbit of Mars. And so all we know is that, figuratively speaking, these things happen, but we don't have a lot of detail. And it was through the interpretation and the tremendous work of Velikovsky that we even know about this, that was exposed to basically the world. And then, of course, standard science came along and said, none of this can happen. This is all pseudoscience, because it didn't agree with the standard narrative of science. But the reality is that it makes a lot more sense, because standard science cannot explain why there are mastodons flash frozen in the tundra 12 feet deep or 15 or 20 feet deep up in Siberia, let alone all kinds of other anomalies around the planet. But I just want to mention that understanding this, I set about many years ago now to create a calendar device so that if there were a pole shift, you would be able to recreate the calendar based on all the new parameters, the spin rate of the Earth, which would change the length of the day, the number of days in an orbit, a single orbit. We'd have potentially a different orbit, which would give us different, the tilt of the Earth could be different, which would give us totally different seasons, etc. So understanding this, I set about to create a device. And I made various models. They were three-dimensional, and they were very complicated to use. And I went through a number of iterations, and they would have cost hundreds of dollars to build and construct and market. And I thought, and a guy told me, he said, the public isn't going to buy this thing. They may, maybe 10 people on the planet would be able to use it and then consider buying it. So it's not going to be like a product that you can do. So I went back and I sat down and I said, okay. Got to make this thing simple, portable, something that will last, something that you can use today as a calendar clock for both sun and stars. Now, this is becoming a big order. This is, it's becoming a tall order, let's put it that way, to put all this into something that's very simple. But in my way of doing things, I sat down, I said, okay, let's look at this. And so I created a product which cost $39.95. Is the recalendar sun star clock is what it's called. The full name is Emergency Survival Recalendar Sun Star Clock, and it's on my webpage. But you can take it, you can use it today, you can set it up any place in the world, northern hemisphere or southern hemisphere. Comes with directions. You set it up, and there's a wheel that comes with it that allows you to calculate the date and the time using the stars at night in both the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere, and you can use the calendar in the daytime. It comes on a plaque that's 8.5 by 11, so literally the size of a sheet of paper. But it's not just any plaque. It's made of a super tough material. It's got a very thin sheet of aluminum on both sides and then a fiber material in the middle, and this stuff is just almost indestructible. If you drove over it with a tank, you could destroy it, but that's about the size of it. And imprinted on one side is the recalendar sun star clock. It also has a table to change between sun and star time and watch time. It also has a dial on there where you can change and build your own calendar going decades, hundreds of years into the future, and hundreds of years in the past. But additionally, this is what I'm trying to get to, is that there's data on it that gives the orbital characteristics of Earth, planet Earth right now, and it puts a date on it. And the way I date it, it is using where the North Pole is in the year 2012, and it's the position of the North Pole in the celestial sphere, and where the its orbit is, etc. So all of this is on this calendar. And so the point is that if, say, we have a pole shift, a massive comet comes in, drives us all back to the cave age, or God help us know that it drives us into extinction. If somebody came back and found this in 10,000 or 100,000 years or, you know, a million years, somebody's traveling through this part of the galaxy and come along Earth and what's going on here, and they dig one up, they could literally build our history and the calendar and the orbit of Earth based on what's written on this plaque. And also, the other thing is that if there were such a pole shift, you could take this and rebuild a calendar. And why is that important? Well, that would tell you when to plant, what the new spring was, how many days in a year, and you would literally be able to rebuild the calendar and the clock, the timepiece that we need, etc. So anyway, this is all on one little plaque. It costs $39.95, and I think is like whatever, $4 shipping or something. It comes in a U.S. Postal, what do they call it, priority mailer, you know, envelope. But something that really, it's a very educational tool, and you can, like I say, you can set it up today and use our sun conditions and star conditions today, any place on the planet, and set it up and have a clock and calendar. And I have kind of a funny story. I was showing it off one time. I was down in the southern hemisphere, and I set it up, and I was kind of like, made pretty good estimates of the north and south, and I had it set up. And there's some circles on there where you can get it very exact using the sun, or you can use these pointing pointers that are on there to use the stars. So I set it up, and there was a guy there, and I set it up, and we looked at it, and it was like 2:20 in the afternoon or something. And he looks at this watch, which he was very proud of. It was a very expensive watch. And he goes, "See, it's wrong." It was like off by 15 minutes or 12 minutes or something. And I said, "Well, no, but we got to correct for sun time to watch time." So I did the little calculation with the chart on the plaque. And I said, "No, if you add the sun time correction, it comes out exactly right." And the guy was just amazed, because it is, it's an amazing little device. Most seafarers would have loved to have one of these on their voyages. Anyway, I'm bringing this up because I'm very tuned to this idea that we could have a pole shift. And if we did, nobody would have the ability to rebuild the axis of Earth and understand where we were or our calendar. And that's what Velikovsky was wrestling with, trying to put a date. But even by putting a date on it, he still didn't know the spin axis of the Earth, where the old North Pole was. I've discovered that independently. And the old North Pole used to be in the state of, or in the province of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. And you can see this as the center point of the Laurentian Ice Cap, which was the great glaciation over North America, which did not extend into Alaska, did not extend into a little bit of Alaska, but did not extend into the land bridge that went to Russia, and did not extend into Russia, which is Siberia now, which is, you know, one of the coldest places on the planet in the Arctic Circle. It was all different then. And so it's very important to understand these things, where the glaciation, for example, when you look at the Laurentian Ice Cap, Greenland was in the Laurentian Ice Cap. So Greenland was glaciated back before the pole shift, and then after the pole shift, when the spin axis of the Earth went up to where it is now, and the ice cap lopped over into northern like Finland and Siberia, and that now fell into the Arctic Circle. Greenland still remained glaciated because it was still within the Arctic Circle. I wanted to get into a little bit of a discussion about Atlantis. I think I'm going to hold that off till next week. But basically, Atlantis has been discovered. It was discovered in the South China Sea, and there's a professor. His name is Aricio Santos. I think he's from Brazil. And he made a... He went through and he studied all of the what we know about Atlantis, all the factors. For example, it was a mountainous city surrounded by a vast plain. And it was big. It was bigger than Asia Minor. So this is a big area. And what is Asia Minor? Well, that would include what we call the Mideast today. So bigger than that. And it had its capital city on an island. And it was he also discovered that the Pillars of Hercules were not the way the Greeks interpreted it as the Rock of Gibraltar, but Krakatoa and its sister volcano in the Strait of Java, where you enter into the South China Sea between Java and Sumatra. And so it all makes sense. But the other thing is, this was back in the 90s, before the internet was very sophisticated. I talk about this in my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. But I was on a web page, and I don't remember how I got there exactly, but there's a technique. It's something you do. You get a long web page, you know, /something/something. And you take off the last piece of it, and that backs you higher up into the tree, into the reference stack of the web page, of the URL. So I backed off, and I backed off, and I backed off, and it was something, as I got back into it, I could see that this was dealing with archaeology, etc. So I end up in a secure website that goes with a naval base that's in northern Australia, and they are... Right there, they're dealing with excavating in the South China Sea, Atlantis. And so, I mean, I was like, I saw this for myself. It was, I have other things to corroborate. I talk about this in my paid cast also. But Atlantis, the mother island, the home continent of Atlantis was in the South China Sea. So anyway, I'll be talking more about that I'm just about out of time here. Remember the webpage. The sale is still on, going to end soon, 10% plus additional 5% off on all the major water filter products. The calendar is there, and the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.